Good evening and welcome to the running consultation on Buddhist wisdom for inner and outer peace. I'm delighted to welcome you this evening. My name is David Goa, director of the Chester Ronning Center. And it is always a particular pleasure here in Camrose to invite a son or daughter of this place to return and to teach a bit. So it's a particular joy for many of us tonight to welcome Kelsang Putsog back to the place that has been important in his life and in his family's life and remains so. Putsog is a Buddhist monk and the resident teacher of a Buddhist center in Calgary, teaches also in Edmonton and various other places. As at least some of you know, he completed his education, or at least one stage of his education, here in Camrose. And I understand one of your claims to fame is that you actually tried to teach the younger Mundel how to play soccer, which, judging from the way he walks, at least my observations, was not an easy matter to do. He has spent some 10 years studying and teaching Buddhist meditation under the guidance of a wonderful Buddhist scholar and meditation master, and we will hear about some of that this evening. I talked with Jack Washenfelder, my colleague, just a little earlier this afternoon, and he mentioned, I had assumed that you had studied with him. And he mentioned that, no, that had not occurred, but that you had come to speak with him on one occasion as a young man about the kind of studies that were offered. And Jack's comment to me was that as he talked with you, he realized that you were not interested in what he called the mind games that so often animate the study of religion in the academic sphere, and that you were interested in plumbing the depths of these matters. And he said to me, he was delighted that you have gone and done that. So thank you for coming. It's nice to have you back in Camrose. We look forward to your conversation with us.
Okay. I'm not used to standing, so I'll sit. Maybe we can begin just by taking a moment of silence inside ourselves. So I'll guide you to just a very brief centering meditation about some peace and calm. So at the heart of Buddhist practice is the thought that each one of us inside ourselves has a capacity to give to the world, and it is in the wish to awaken that capacity that we journey as spiritual beings. And so in the heart of the Buddhist tradition is the practice of meditation, which we can understand as a way to connect with that inner potential that lies inside each and every living being. So this evening, I hope to share with you some of the things that I've learned. But in order for us to hear at the deepest level, our minds need to open at that deeper place. And in our lives, we are often so busy and so crazy-minded that the deeper part of ourself at times is forgotten. And so in many ways it's a matter of us tuning in to that part of ourself. So as we begin any study or practice of spiritual teachings, what is most important is not necessarily the qualifications of the teacher, because as they say, the teacher is everywhere. But of particular importance is the qualities of the student. That if we have a very open, clear, peaceful, pure, and receptive mind, the teacher is everywhere. So as we begin to receive wisdom, it's important to quiet our minds, make them clear, and develop a connection with that deeper part of ourself towards which we are journeying. So this preparation has two parts, and you could say those two parts constitute the entirety of the path, which is, one is developing a pure motivation for our journey. And that purity of heart comes from our wish that whatever gifts we discover, they are there to share to the world, with the world. And so our intent is one of compassion. Our intent is to awaken our gifts so that we can share with the world around us. So that intention is a heart that wishes to benefit others. And then secondly, the other aspect of our path is a wish to develop a clarity of understanding. Because how can we help others unless we are awake or wise ourselves? So we have two parts to our path. One is a wish to benefit others, and the second is a wish to develop wisdom, a deeper knowledge in how we can actually accomplish this. If you follow these two wishes in your life, you will become an enlightened person. For sure. If you follow a wish to care for others, and if you wish to deepen your greatest wisdom in order to accomplish that, you will become an awakened being. So let's begin with a meditation to cultivate those two parts within ourselves. So meditation is quite simple. We can begin with a posture that is as clear and as alert as you can think, whilst remaining relaxed. So find a comfortable posture where you feel relaxed. And then turn your mind and thoughts inside yourself. You can begin simply by noticing the physicalness of your body. Begin to soften. Soften your thoughts. Soften your physical body. And with this softening, we can begin to become more aware of our inner and outer experience. this awareness, with this opening to the world, we can begin to cultivate our wish of loving compassion. Our wish to bring peace, harmony, gentleness, and care to the world. Can turn our thoughts, our care, to the world around us and cultivate our deepest of intentions. Which is the wish to bring care and compassion to this world. Compassionate intention is our Buddha nature, the nature of our heart. We can slowly rise from meditation. Distractions. Okay. It's probably one of the most important parts of the path is that we never get too serious. So it's very nice to be here. It feels very right to out. Actually, I have a cell phone and it went off today too. No one knows my number and it's never on. I think sometimes when we're trying to be wise, we get a bit serious, but I think one of the main wishes is that most of our lives aren't very serious. In fact, most of our lives, I think we feel like we're bumbling around, I'm speaking personally, not sure what I'm supposed to be doing. And spirituality feels like this distant thing that other people do somewhere else. And my own life is just a crazy mess of disturbing thoughts and negative vibes. So what I would like to hope, one of my wishes for this evening is that we begin to demystify a spiritual path and what it means to live a life of compassion and depth. Because if this world is to transform, it must touch our life as we know it. And must feel like we can live our life as we know it. And at the same time, begin and deepen, a journey that is very profound. I always thought that sitting in Camrose, and I remember having this thought in Mom and Dad's bedroom, I thought, the answers are right here. Because, you know, we went to the United Church, so I understood things in terms of God. I thought, well, if God's so powerful, he's got to be right here. Like, I don't need to go anywhere. But I had this sense that I had to do a lot of wandering around to try to figure it out. But then what I would end up doing is coming back to the very same place where I started and recognizing that it was there all along. And so hopefully... I have done some wandering. It's okay. I was late for every English 30 class I ever attended. Okay. Anyways, that's kind of just one of my intentions. And then the other intention is just, as Dr. Goh has suggested, and I think it's a good idea, just to talk. You know? You guys have ideas and thoughts and maybe some questions or things you'd like to contribute so we can have some discussion. So where would you like to begin? Well,
and you take the path to Buddhism versus other religions?
Because it's the best.
Was he hired?
That guy?
Yeah.
There are. There's about 40 of them. Well, I don't know. Maybe you did because you were one of my Sunday school teachers. And, I remember going to the United Church and, you know, being asked to think and to question. And I wouldn't really say that my path is different from that place. I'd say it's a continuum of that quest. And I just found something that resonated with my next step in terms of what I was doing, and I had no clue I'd ever be wearing things like this. I don't even know how to put them on still. But it's kind of like your life just leads you forward and you take another step. And I think one of the things I've appreciated is the willingness to ask the question and not know the answer. Because then the answer surprises you and takes you someplace you never thought you'd ever be. So I remember studying in university Buddhism and thinking it was very antisocial. You know, these people going after nirvana. I thought that's not what I wanted. And, but later on finding myself becoming a Buddhist, but for other reasons. Dad says I need to speak up. Well, I'd say for sure the continuum of my journey was about a wish to care for others. That was a value that, you know, was really deeply instilled in me through my parents and community. And as many of you know, I did a lot of traveling. Kind of looking, seeking. I guess maybe what it came down to is there's something inside of us that holds a key to whether or not we create suffering for others or we create compassion. And I think it was that recognition that called me to seek very deeply, because I wondered, well, why is there suffering? Why do people suffer? And where does it come from? And what can we do about it? And I kept asking that question, and I came to the conclusion that had to do with something inside of ourselves. And because I recognized that everyone who acts in the world is a person, just a human person, and they act because of what they feel inside themselves in a very human way. And I saw that in myself. And in looking inside, there's these different parts of ourselves, you know? There's that kindness, that tenderness, that compassion. And then there are also parts of ourselves that are uncertain and unclear and confused and at times selfish. And I saw that place, that inner place, is the arena for what occurs in the global stage. You know? Like, it's people that go to war, not machines. It's people, human beings, that hurt each other. You know, nobody forces anybody. And it's people that create a consumer culture. And why? What creates that culture? Well, it's something that's going on inside the people that create those actions. And I thought, if you want to change the world, you have to touch that place. Otherwise, you may change something externally, like put in rules or policies or sign a peace treaty, but you don't actually change the mechanism that's producing our experience and our actions. I don't know, and I didn't know a lot about how really to help people. You know, we used to go one human being in front of you, and you give yourself license to help them, and you come to realize you haven't got a clue what really to do, because you don't know. Well, I didn't know even how to help myself. It's kind of asking those questions, those basic questions, and just seeing I didn't know a lot, and thinking I could use some wisdom, and I could use a teacher. That's what it came down to. I wanted to find somebody I could look at that person and think, that guy knows. He really knows. Or she. And I'd like them to teach me. And so, as they say, when the student's ready, the teacher comes. I knew exactly what I was looking for. And so, indirectly I found my teacher through a center he'd established in Toronto, and then upon meeting him in person, I really recognized for myself, I'd found my teacher, someone who I felt embodied the qualities that I wanted to possess, and was explaining how to do that. It just so happened he was Buddhist. But because I admired that person so much and felt that his gift that he'd given me and to others was so precious, that I wanted to follow in his footsteps. So I ended up ordaining as a Buddhist monk 7 years ago now, which is... yeah. Long enough to ask lots of interesting questions about what it means to be a Buddhist monk in Alberta. I love that part, asking questions, because I often don't know what is a Buddhist monk supposed to do now, but I am one. So it's like making it up as you go along. But that this, you know, there's a beautiful discipline. But the discipline isn't in the wall, but it's in finding out your path. So I enjoy that so much. Very much. I remember the first time I gave a talk in Camrose, it was at Poplar Books, and it's like everyone I knew came. And I remember, I think it was Pat Mundell, she asked, well, this inner searching is all fine and dandy, but what about compassion in the real world? And I gave some kind of Buddhist answer. But then I ended up going home, and Mom said to me, she said, you know, there were 50 or 70 people in that place, and each of them made an intention to be a better person. And if that doesn't change the world, then what will? So very simple like that. So David and I were talking before. I'm not sure, is it Dr. Gore or David?
I'm
not
sure.
Okay.
I'm named for a king. It doesn't get any better.
King David and I were talking about that before. You know, this interplay between a spirituality of profundity and living in the world. So I think in my life now, the classes I teach in Calgary mostly these days, are that wish, is just a wish to offer profound teachings to everyday people like us. And they just show up on a Wednesday night or whenever, and instead of going curling that night, they show up at a Buddhist lecture and receive some wisdom and then go back to regular life and try to dialogue between that wisdom and the people they meet, their families, their jobs. And I can say that there's a lot of wisdom, you know, in all the traditions. And I've had the good fortune to study for a long time and in very I feel a lot of gratitude for the situations I've been able to be present to, and I feel grateful now for the opportunity to share some of what I've heard and learned with you. So many neat things about the way our minds work and everything. Yeah.
I don't know if you could discuss how you navigate through the consumer culture that you talked about in compassionate ways.
Yeah.
Or how you compassionately navigate.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the word that comes to mind is kindness. And, because where does consumer culture come from? And how am I a member of that culture? So for example, yesterday, sometimes it's nice being a monk because people think they're supposed to bring you offerings. So anyways, on Monday night someone gave me a bar of Toblerone, and which is all right with me. And they put on a little note saying that they are enjoying the classes and actually happiness does come from chocolate. But you just have to have all the pieces. And so anyways, I thought, okay, So now comes the dilemma, you know. How do I act compassionately with a bar of Toblerone? So anyway, I thought, well, I'm supposed to give it away. So anyways, I thought I'd bring it home. Maybe share with my family. So anyway, so I was very disciplined until this morning. I put it beside my bed because I wanted to remember. It was a very lovely note. And once a month we do a little fast and just have one meal in the day, which isn't terribly a big deal. But anyways, you're a bit hungry in the morning after. So I woke up and I had this bar of Toblerone. Sorry, Dad. Next to my bed. And there it is. Consumer culture in my world. And what do I do? And we can do all sorts of things. We can be just forget it, you know, just indulge, which is a nice option from time to time. But that's it. It's so accessible. I just need to reach out my hand. It's Toblerone. And I've worked hard, you know. Had my spiritual day yesterday. Well, what do I do? And I feel it's in that very moment that's where we learn to navigate consumer culture. Because there it is. It's me. I want to consume for sure. And this is where the spiritual path begins. Because the answer isn't to pull out the big stick. You can try for like a week or two and force yourself to do something. But in forcing yourself, you find that there's a tender human person there that has needs or perceived needs. But just because they're perceived needs doesn't make any less of the difficulty. And so, how do you gently guide that being, who is yourself, to a place of peace in a way that is kind, respectful, empowering, liberating? And I'd say we often don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. And our journey, because there isn't an answer, because you may do many things, but our journey is to liberate that person from that place. So whatever they do is a path that leads to freedom. I won't tell you what I did. Because spirituality can give us lots of like technical things to understand here, but it's the awakening of the heart that is the true response. And that requires a gentle and skillful hand. And that gentleness and that skill comes from the awakening of our own wisdom. Because then we can be a beautiful guide, saying, come this way, and this is how. And that's perfect. Nobody wants to be enslaved by a chocolate bar. But in that moment, to have the skill and the capacity and the wisdom to walk through that perfectly, you know, that's an amazing spiritual quality. With many, many levels. And you can never tell the answer by what somebody does. Maybe that person ate the tokan. But how come? Is that an act of kindness? Generosity? Maybe they didn't eat the tokan. Is that an act of discipline? So some days I eat the Toblerone and some days I don't. In any other thoughts?
There are some religions that aren't very tolerant of other religions. Like some consider anybody outside of their religion to be an infidel.
Yep.
How does Buddhism regard other religions? Is one similar to what I have mentioned if they are outside of that religion?
Well, I don't know. I think I always make a, I try to make a distinction between a practitioner and the path that they are following. And sometimes a practitioner may think one thing, but that may not necessarily reflect the deeper roots of that tradition. So I would imagine that Buddhists have many opinions, like we all do. Taught that every living being without exception has Buddha nature, and that that nature is indestructible, and that that compassionate nature appears everywhere. I once asked my teacher Geshe-la, I always thought about, you know, many of you know our part of our family's roots is in Africa, and I've always thought of maybe, I don't know, connecting there someday. And so I asked Geshe-la in a meeting with the teachers from around the world how we were to, I said, introduce the Dharma to places where there is no Dharma. And so he said, first of all, there is no place where there is no Dharma. There's no place where there is no Dharma. He said, everywhere there are people acting out of compassion. Everywhere. And I think any spiritual path will facilitate the practitioner to recognize that, to rather than entrench or create boundaries, they'll soften them. Because where is there not a place where truth can be seen? Where is there not a place where compassion cannot be born? And I think the relationship between a particular spiritual path and that universality is that a particular path is a way to help you see. And the value of particular lineages is that we give ourselves we give ourselves to a way of thinking that releases our mind and ultimately takes us beyond that particular tradition. But particular traditions are valuable in that they contain their own integrity that helps people who allow themselves to be influenced by that integrity to awaken. Is that an okay response? Did you have another question to that? Is that okay? Avalokiteshvara is the Buddha of compassion. So in Buddhism there are lots of different Buddhas who embody various qualities. And at one time, many times, Geshe has often said that the emanations of Buddha are countless in the world. I thought, how is that possible? He must be living in a different world, you know? Because there aren't even, there's 6 billion humans. Countless is a lot more than 6 billion. So I was thinking about that. I've been thinking about that for a long time. And so emanations of Buddhas are Buddhas that appear in forms we can see. They're manifestations of that enlightened compassion. So I was thinking, anytime anyone goes to visit someone in the hospital, for example, they're an emanation of compassion. Because their appearance arises from the heart of compassion. And they are appearing there solely out of a compassionate intention. So I thought, surely, anyone with that heart must be an emanation of the Buddha of compassion. And as such, the emanations are countless. And that universal compassion, which connects us all, we all have that capacity, you know? We all have that spiritual capacity for compassion. And whenever we act out of it, we can say we are an emanation of that Buddha, embodying that quality for others. Our problem is we're not emanating all the time as that enlightened person. But anyways, we can. And so I feel like that, at least that understanding has helped me to lessen the gap between enlightened beings and me. Because sometimes I am an enlightened being, you know? Flashes, like lightning in a dark sky, but it's there, you know? And I think the spiritual path is just trying to awaken that more and more inside of ourselves, so we're always acting out of that pure nature.
You began saying that the spiritual path is the day-to-day. So, and many of us are on different spiritual paths.
Yeah.
But what would you say is the key? Well, and you did say caring for others.
Yeah.
But I maybe to hear more about that, or to hear more about some of the disciplines that you use, that everybody uses sort of, but they're, you know, particular to what you do.
Sure.
Day-to-day.
Yeah. Well, I love the Toblerone incident. Like, I love that. Because I feel like the cosmos is erupting inside of us all the time. All the time. Like, all the dictators in the world, they're right here. You know? I remember collapsing under the weight of my compassion many times. You know? As oppressive as far as strong as that was. So I feel like inside of our hearts we have the window to everything. We are tender living beings who suffer. You know? Who is not a tender living being who suffers? We are we grasp at our own ideas and get irked when other people have different ideas. that aren't enlightened like mine. And we get defensive, we get argumentative, we get stressed out, all sorts of things, everything. And so I feel the day-to-day spiritual life is about entering our own life with the eyes of an enlightened being, how whatever form that takes for you, and becomes a dialogue between yourself and your spiritual guide, where your guide is helping you to see you and how inside you you have unbelievable potential for enlightened action, and you also have unbelievable capacity to be a Scrooge. And then in entering your world and in liberating your world in all the ways that you have to face that every day of your life, then you develop the capacity and insight in how to help others, because they're exactly the same. Exactly the same. No one is different. Just like me. I know you guys have Toblerone incidents. I know. I know that we all get nervous. I know that there's so many fears. I know that so many confusions. I know all of that. I know there's so many desires. Because I know them in myself. So it's like I know you. And then being kind and insightful in my own world, I know we can help each other. Sure, yeah.
It seems to me, Kunsei, that before we can work on the spiritual path, we have to get it in our head. And I found some of the ideas of Buddhism very, very helpful, like the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Seems to me that you need something to hang your head on. That's just guidelines, and ultimately you have to find your own path, of course. But these are structures that I would think tremendous assistance. Maybe you could mention or comment on that.
Yeah. Oh. That's a big, good question. We need structure.
Mm-hmm.
We need structure.
Yes.
For sure. Because although the teachings are all around us, we don't have the eyes to know. And there are so many things about you don't know. You don't know. And we so need someone with clarity that can point out, help us see ourselves. And so for sure, that point and its value in an authentic spiritual life can't be underestimated.
I have a question that I've pondered for years, because it was asked in the context of the terror of history. And it was asked by a Buddhist. And it was asked about his mother. And I'd like to just tell you this little story. And it has to do, it hinges on on such a central Buddhist idea, the idea of acceptance. And the shadow side of that, resignation. Mac Nishiyama was 12 years old when the Canadian government came and took his father and his older brother to the concentration camp that we set up in 1940 for the Japanese living on the coast, Steveston. And since he was only 12, he got to stay with his mother in their house there. But then some months later, the officials called and said that they could move to Alberta. And maybe, the father and the other son would be released from the camp and could come and live in Alberta. But they were going to move no matter what, and it was going to happen at 7 o'clock in the morning. This was 7 o'clock at night. And they needed to remove everything out of their house. This was not just them, but many people at Steveston, the whole Japanese community. About a year before, the Nishiyamas had purchased a McClary Easy stove. A wonderful stove that Mac's mother adored. And it was a kind of prize for them, a joy for them. So that night, they spent packing things up and moving them outside. And the last thing they moved outside was the McClary Easy stove. And at 6:30 in the morning, the buses pulled in, along with the officials, and everybody had to get on board, not quite knowing where they're going. And Mac, a 12-year-old boy, walks out of the house ahead of his mother to get on the bus. And he steps onto the bus, and then he stops and he turns around and he steps off and looks back. And there he sees his mother with her hands folded, the juzu around her hands, the gesture made before the Buddha of infinite compassion, the Amida Buddha, in the service of thanksgiving in their home or in the Buddhist church. And she is gushing with tears in her eyes to the McClary Easy stove. And he says, acceptance or resignation? Acceptance or resignation? He's devout in a lovely way, but it's been a haunting question for him from within the very heart of his faith. And not just a historical question, of course, a question for him with a kind of historical referent. And I can't imagine all the Tibetans saying that these days as well. So in the midst of the terror of history, wisdom for inner and outer peace. Acceptance. Resignation. Can you just walk around it?
That's my Auntie Carol.
Thank you.
Kind of makes me wonder in my own spiritual life I've come to terms with the question you're asking and the place where that question is coming from.
One of the things that's been remarkable for me in the little work I've done in the Japanese Buddhist community in southern Alberta. And it, in a sense, it's a kind of footnote to Mac's question, is that that community all got one-way tickets, got off the train on a Tuesday afternoon, picked up by Mormon and Mennonite and Dutch and various other farmers, and taken to work on the sugar beet fields, living mainly in granaries that had been cleaned out the night before. But the farmers who brought them to do the work were also relatively poor. And through the whole war, not one of them was put in jail. There was not one protest. Not one of them ended up in a clinic or a hospital for mental illness. And none of the children became delinquents. So as I reflect on that, it seems to me that the gift of Buddhism for these people was sort of fell into relief. That Buddhism, it's teaching that all things change. And you can only pretend to hang on and make them stable. You can pretend, but they all change. The teaching that all is dukkha, all is suffering, but if you don't hang on, you have some chance to have that kind of peace that you talk about in the midst of it. That whatever is the residue of that question for my friend Mac about his mother who has departed this world, that in fact the witness, to use a very good Christian phrase, the witness of the community in the midst of that is absolutely extraordinary. Within 10 years of the end of the war, Japanese men and women served on all of the organizations in those towns in roles of leadership, some of them Bürgermeisters in the towns. There was an ability to put the world together, to not assume that the terror of history itself would not change and was not absolute. It's an amazing local story about the community in this part of the world.
It makes me think also well, in our well, we all have to face the terror of our circumstance, which is each one of us, the teachings tell us, will be taken away without any notice. And we will be taken to an unknown destination. And that destination may not be good. Mm-hmm. And through the teachings on death and impermanence, we are encouraged to face that part of our existence. And so the stories of these people isn't the story of others, mm-hmm. but it's the story of ourselves. And almost no one, very few outside of well, I shouldn't say this, but it's hard. I know it's hard for us to face that. And so the teachings say that if you have the courage to face that, which is your own story, then through facing that, you will be given life. But until we face that, our life will not be we will not have the gift of freedom mm-hmm. until we face that.
When I was a little boy, every Victoria Day we planted the garden. We don't even remember Victoria anymore, but we planted the garden, and I remember every year it was similar, making the row, taking the seeds, putting them slowly in the garden. My father on this side, me on this side, 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old. And at some point on that day, usually in a surprising way, I would hear my father call my name, David, David, unless ye become like a seed and fall into the ground and die, you will not live. That's all. No, words from the gospel, but words that echo with this profound understanding of at some point having to hold lightly our mortality, our finitude.
Sure. I think also when it becomes a place of familiarity, it loses a sense of fear and foreboding. Mm-hmm. One of the gifts I feel of the Buddhist teachings is their articulation of the process of death and dying. And with familiarity and understanding, it need not be a place that is foreign to us, but a place that is entirely natural and a part of our life, and in deeply appreciating that part of our cycle, we can also in turn more appreciate the part of our life cycle. So initially it's fearsome because we don't know much about it. But with knowledge and understanding, it can be a joyous place and one of peace, the deepest peace.
I just add another view
my understanding that has been very helpful for me is, and I've told many of my friends this over and over again, and of course it's very difficult to understand, but the Buddha said everything's perfect the way it is. How can that be? And once you come to the realization that he speaks the truth, then a lot of things fall into place. The suffering becomes bearable because you know the suffering is illusion. It's maybe not an illusion for those who are suffering, and of course the function of the teacher, I suppose, is to help one see that it is an illusion. But the key to it, of course, is what you two were just speaking about, is coming to terms with death. Because it becomes very clear, whether it's in Buddhism or Christianity, the fundamental system that you're going to have to come to deal with, of course, is the question of death. And both Christ and Buddha make it clear, at least in their opinion, there is no such thing as death. So if there is no death, there is nothing to fear. If you're an eternal spirit, spiritual being, this little interval on earth is a passing. And as the Buddha said, it's the great gift of human life, which is the most precious gift. Yeah. But that precious gift is that it's a passing answer to anything. But, you know, if you can, through pathways of your life, come to see the truth of that claim, then all of a sudden the world looks very, very different. And it's kind of a difficult concept because if it's all perfect the way it is, what are my duties of action? But as you could mention the Bodhisattva vow, you know, I mean, we know that there's still action required. As long as there is illusion, it has to be dispelled. So we're still there to act with compassion for those who have not tasted the bliss. Does that make any sense?
I never thought of it before, Harry, but that comment by the Buddha, everything is perfect, is a kind of brilliant critique of utopian dreaming. That is a great problem for human beings, is they want to imagine and then live in their imagination. They want to imagine the world differently than it is and live there, which is to not live, which is in fact what the Christian tradition would call death. So when he says that, at least in part what he's saying, is the way it is the way it is. And you don't get anything else. So wake up. So I'd be interested to know what the word perfect is and how that's translated here. But it is in itself a kind of critique of a fundamental human mental habit, which is to have a utopian dream about life and
want
try to live
otherwise.
There. Yeah.
Otherwise.
Yeah. That's interesting.
My Sunday school teacher.
Buddhist philosophy, if the judgments from right and wrong? Are you Dhamma or not?
Yeah. Maybe this helps articulate or add to what Harry was saying. I think one of the things as we deepen our compassion and self-awareness is we learn to accept that all things have many parts, and so there isn't an intrinsic truth to anything. So oftentimes we rigidly hold right and wrong as if there was a heaviness in that judgment. So I think in the teachings we're shown how to develop greater discrimination, so greater self-awareness. And there is a great deal of time spent to articulate and clarify pathways of inside ourselves that lead to positive directions and pathways that lead in unwholesome directions. So you could say there is a discrimination of virtue and non-virtue. And I guess for me what's most helpful about deepening our spiritual life is we come to hold a dilemma or a question and appreciate the many ways that we can approach that. And so from some points of view we can say this is a better direction than others, but we don't hold that as an absolute, but we appreciate the many intricacies that every person and every situation affords. I think the more closely we examine things, the less fundamental our ideas are, in the negative sense of the word. That's kind of a roundabout answer.
How do we nurture contemplation and compassion in youth who are by nature and are quite self-centered part of their lives?
Yeah. Well, two ways come to mind. One is we must find it in ourselves and offer it by example. And because any time they ask a question, they have the opportunity to encounter a reflective answer. But unless we establish some degree of reflection and contemplation within our own life, we can neither provide the example nor the guidance that is helpful for them. That's one. And then the other that I feel we often neglect is as we see that capacity within ourselves, we begin to recognize it in others. And maybe, as you're saying, many people can't recognize that capacity they have. And so that's why they need teachers who can see that potential that as of this moment is unmanifest. And then in our relationship with them, draw it forward. So in this sense, I feel the greatest teacher isn't one who corrects, but one who draws or awakens that which isn't seen.
Midwifery.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Midwifery. Socrates.
But But that capacity certainly rests on our own, you know, our own journey.
I've heard a number of monks say that it's really hard to explain the law of karma to Westerners because it's such a foreign concept to us.
Yeah.
How would you do it? Explain it to a bunch of Western Canadians?
They're the hardest, actually. I love karma because it makes so much sense. So Buddha teaches that everything, the world that you live in, arises from your consciousness, and that the world of your experience arises from your action, or karma. So karma is a Sanskrit word that means action. So the best way to do this is through example. So let's say
somebody gave you Toblerone.
I knew that was going to come up. Okay, so let's say you go to work, you may have a job, and someone at that work is says many things that are hurtful to us. So they say something that's hurtful to us on Wednesday, and we go home. So with our thoughts we will create karma, which means action. So let's say on the Wednesday evening we think about it and we start to feel worse. That hurt grows, so we don't know what to do with it. And we start to get upset, and we tell a friend, and they say that was so horrible what they said. You know, why are they saying things like that? And we start to build up that hurt, and we don't want to see them anymore. Like, we feel that awkwardness. We don't want to encounter them the next day because what are we going to say? And you know, it was very unkind. And so on Thursday we go to meet our karma, our action, the product of our action. Now let's say that Wednesday evening we engaged in another action or actions. Let's say we had we were skilled in the depth of accepting our emotion, and we opened to that feeling, and let's say we cried, and let's say in the midst of those tears we felt our co-worker's sorrow. And let's say we understood that we were both experiencing suffering. And let's say that awakened a tenderness of appreciation for where they were coming from. And so the next day we would go and face our karma, our action. So the world of the Thursday doesn't arise from its own side, nor does the co-worker we meet, but they are a product of our action. Our ignorance tells us that the person comes from out there, but wisdom tells us they come from here. That's karma. One of the difficulties with karma is we have many thoughts that come from many places, but they all come from inside. It's a very hopeful teaching, because it means tomorrow, the world of tomorrow can be anything. And we're not bound to live in a world of division or suffering. I believe that teaching shows us how to free the world. But I mean, you know, how to do that spiritually is very profound. Fun action, but I think something that we can all relate to in our own way.
That was as good as it gets. Thanks for that lovely reflection on karma. Thank you so much for coming. I hope some people need to go, I know, but others, you're sure welcome to stay and talk. And we look forward to having that conversation with you. Thank you so much. Lovely of you to come.